Welcome to Driven to Business with your host, Eddie Mayfield. Driven to Business is a business forum program that focuses on success principles in business. And now, it's time for Driven to Business.
Good morning and welcome to this week's edition of Driven to Business. I'm Eddie Mayfield. We're glad you're here. Let me remind you, we're streaming live on biz1190.com. And today's program will be podcast on eddiemayfield.com and on iTunes. By the way, you can subscribe to us on iTunes, so be sure and do that. Here on Driven to Business, we like talking about business. We've talked to everybody on here from the presidents of large corporations down to one-man shows, and I enjoy all of it. But I particularly enjoy talking to people that have founded a business, and particularly a business that's based on their passions. And our guest today is that way. Our guest today is George Petch. George is the owner and the founder of Maple Street Guitars right here in the Buckhead area of Atlanta. George, welcome to Driven to Business.
Thank you, Eddie.
George, I guess one good way to start off, by the way, I should say in terms of full disclosure, I'm a very satisfied customer of Maple Street Guitars. I know a lot of very satisfied customers of Maple Street Guitars. George, tell us just how and why you started Maple Street.
The how's probably pretty easy, but the why is really has to do with how I got started with playing the instruments. So I started playing the guitar when I was 21 in 1971. Wow. I started lessons at a shop that was right here in Buckhead. It was called Sutherland's House of Guitars. And when I grew up, I didn't grow up in a family where any instrument was a part of the family, not even my extended family. But I always had an interest in instruments. And then, of course, in high school in the 60s, guitars were very popular, but I didn't have one. And so not having one, I always kind of wanted one. And it came a time where when I was about 21, I was in a position to buy a guitar and start guitar lessons. I had learned a few things on the guitar just by picking it up from friends up to that point. And so I had two sort of audition pieces. I could play Blackbird by the Beatles and Freight Train by Elizabeth Cotton. And yeah, I wanted to learn to play fingerstyle guitar in particular, not electric guitar. And I also was very interested in learning about music in a formal fashion. I wanted to learn about theory. I wanted to learn about, you know, technique and so on. And I was led to look into learning to play classical guitar because that was a fingerstyle approach to the guitar. And that was something I knew nothing about. And I thought, well, if that was like being able to play Classical Gas by Mason Williams, I was there. You know, take me there. I thought that would be the tops if I could achieve that. So I found my way to the shop, and there were two people there, John Sutherland and Lister Bass, and they were two pioneers kind of teaching classical guitar in the city of Atlanta. Another was Charlie Duncan, and he was teaching out of his home, so I couldn't find him. And anyway, I started lessons there. I auditioned. I was accepted, and I thought that was a great thing. And I got involved with that and in that shop and then learned about the music through the records that were introduced to me, and when I heard the music for the classical guitar, it was like that was it. I turned off the radio in 1971 and haven't quite turned it back on yet, and got involved in the classical guitar and the study of it, started teaching there actually after about a year and a half of taking lessons, and that fixed me on the path of teaching the guitar. And then to learn the guitar more formally and to learn music more formally, music first, I had to find out if I was competent to study music, having not grown up with it. So I went to Clayton Junior College at the time, asked them if I could simply sign up to take their music courses, not for credit. I'll just pay them. Let me just come and see if I could do this. And I did that. And then in that interim, in the middle 70s, you know, there were no, I won't say no, there were only maybe a dozen colleges in the at the university level, or colleges and universities, I should say, that offered classical guitar in a program around the country. And Georgia was deciding to add one to their music program. And it's so John Sutherland was tapped to be the teacher there. And it was that after I finished the courses at Clayton Junior College that I decided I should audition, you know, for a full-time kind of study of music. And it was a now or never moment. I was like 26 years old by this time. I'm going back to school to study music. Can I do this? Well, I did it. And so the way it worked out, I was able to audition and start as a junior on the guitar at the University of Georgia, but I was a freshman academically. But that allowed me to finish their four-year program in 2.5 years. Wow. And so I commuted from Atlanta to to Athens each week. It was kind of a big deal, and I felt like a monk or something. All I did was study and practice, and in that back and forth between Atlanta and Athens, I would teach here and I would teach there. And finally, when I finished, I was teaching at Sutherland's, but it turned out that they were going to move their shop. And at that time, this was like 1979, I was interested in trying to do something on my own. And so when they moved their shop, I made the decision to investigate opening my own business, mostly as a teaching studio first.
Right.
And so that's, like I said, that was the easy part. I was already doing that. I had 40 to 50 students, but I was also getting involved in an early music ensemble at Emory and working with other instrumentalists, flute players, and singers, trying to create ensembles for myself. So performing was the big bit. That's what I really enjoyed doing. The teaching was a stable bit. You know, I could do that and depend on it. And,
well, it seems like with 40, I mean, that's not a minor number of students there for when you've got to be teaching 40 or 50 students.
That's a lot of students.
Yeah.
You're teaching, 5 to 6 days a week.
Yeah.
And then if on top of that you're doing performances and
right.
trying to have other activities with the instrument, it's a challenge on your time for practice. There was at that time also a classical guitar society in Atlanta that was formed in 1978, maybe earlier, but I was nominated president in 1978.
Wow.
So for 12 years, from 1978 to 1990, I and quite a few other passionate volunteers brought on average 4 events to Atlanta each year for concerts and then master classes, workshops. And so I was organizing that with the help of these other folks and teaching. And I needed to have a place to do this for myself, and I spent a year kind of seeing if I could work up my nerve to rent a space to open a studio. I also, on the advice of some very good business people, looked into the idea of opening a music shop, a store. But so I interviewed a lot of the companies that were located here in Atlanta for distribution of music instruments.
Right.
Because I had worked at Sutherland's, I had experience with other companies, though their products at Sutherland's were simply classical guitars. None of the electric guitars. It wasn't a general music store. Spending a year looking into that, I realized I really didn't want to borrow money. I'd worked up a prospectus, but I didn't want to borrow money and go into the music retail business, because I wasn't passionate about retail. I was passionate about the music. And but when you're a teacher, you're interested in the student's best interest. You're trying to do your best to give them good instruction. They're placing their trust in you, but it's disturbing sometimes when they come to a lesson all eager to play and they have a brand new guitar, and that guitar is a reason to quit because it's hard to play or not set up properly. So I got started adjusting their guitars and setting their guitars up for them. When I opened the shop, I thought, well, I'll have a small group of things that I could offer to the students that I could pre-select. I would be kind of an agent for their interest. That was my goal. And at that time, there were a number of instrument distributors in Atlanta. I did have a business license. I originally incorporated the business as Atlanta Guitar Center. That was the name of the business.
Really?
Yeah, 1981. And so we operated, as that until 1997. Then I changed the name actually to Maple Street Guitars at that time. So nevertheless, I would go out to these local warehouses and handpick all the instruments that I wanted to have for the shop, because it was my goal to have best examples. And
right.
That's been the goal all along. And then what happened very soon after I opened the business as a teaching studio, a number of other people that I had known who had taught at some shops and some who were colleagues at the University of Georgia wanted to teach with me. And my goal was to have, a business that would hopefully be, an asset to the community,
so, right.
so to have resources and things for people who are interested in learning to play music, and to have, best quality resources and best quality people to assist in that goal. So so as a teaching staff grew, I needed bigger space, and then I recruited some folks who were not just classical guitar players, and some others who taught electric guitar, of course, folk guitar, rock guitar, jazz guitar, and the group of people who work with me still today. I mean, many have been there for more than 30 years.
Right.
So it's kind of unusual, I think, to have a quality of staff for that long a period.
It's actually, I think, listening to you talk, you know, as I have talked to you before the program, I'm a as you know, I bought a guitar from you. But I'm not in your league as a player. And I'm sitting here. It's amazing to me. That, number one, when you started off saying you started at 21, I would have figured you were a kid that started at five.
I wish
or something.
Yeah,
playing guitar like from where you are, and it's just it really is quite amazing. And the other thing that you know, you are known in this area, for those that are outside Atlanta area, perhaps listening on the internet may not know, is that you are considered a quality shop around here. You know, there are plenty of places to buy guitars, as you sure know, including online and all over the place. There's not any problem to buy guitars. But you know, when you walk into Maple Street, you feel like you're with the guy behind the counter. Most of the time can answer any question you've got about a guitar, pretty much.
I hope so, yeah.
Yeah. That really is quite impressive. You know, I have a friend that I've never taken classical guitar. I started off with a Mel Bay chord book. That's pretty much, and I had a buddy that in high school that was a folk guitarist, and I sort of liked what he did. In fact, he's kind of in the bluegrass now. His name is Bobby Wilson. He lives up in East Tennessee, a very good banjo picker now, as a matter of fact. But, you know, Bobby got me interested in folk music back in those days, and he had never had any lessons, and I never had any. I'd had some piano lessons, so I sort of had a little bit of theory from that. I had 4 years of piano, and which is very helpful, by the way, to, I think, even in playing guitar, to understand the structures and so forth. Mm-hmm. But just the idea of you did a business out of your passion like that, I think is really a fascinating idea. I have a friend that's in I have a friend out in Texas, the only person I know that's an opera singer, he had told me one time, we were talking about asking, what in the world drew you into opera? I mean, you know, that's not something, at least where I grew up, you didn't grow up wanting to be an opera singer. I didn't know anybody that ever did want to do that. And he said, in his opinion, that opera was the Olympics of music, the way he looked at it. I actually think classical guitar is the Olympics of guitar music in a way, because, you know, you can just whack around on chords and stuff, and like I do, and things, and get by with it. But when you start playing classical, that's a whole other ball game right there. George, you're a great guest. Hang around through the break. You're listening to Driven to Business. I'm Eddie Mayfield. We're here every Saturday morning at 11 o'clock right here on Atlanta's Business Radio, Biz 1190. Don't go anywhere. Stick around. Welcome back to Driven to Business. I'm Eddie Mayfield. We're talking today with George Petch, who's the owner and the founder of Maple Street Guitars right here in Buckhead, very near the station here, as a matter of fact. George, you were telling us about your background in music and how you started this basically as a passion for teaching, and you actually have which is uncommon, as I'm sure you know, for a lot of guitar players. It's uncommon to have a college degree in music like you do. There are a lot of guitar players don't have it. Now, perhaps over in the classical area that you're in, that may be more common. I don't know about that, but
yes, that would be a necessity.
Is that
today.
Right?
Well, it's not a necessity. Segovia never had one, for example. But
right.
But it's today, if you're going to teach, and it's not for performance, but if you're going to be teaching, you would have to go through probably a college program. I mean, particularly to teach in a college program.
Right.
I taught as an adjunct as well, you know,
right.
for Clayton State College later, and like most of the teachers, or many of them at least in our shop, they've served as college professors. So you have to have a degree for that. But in the 1970s, most of the people who were being solicited to start programs had no degree in music with the guitar. If they
right.
had a degree in music, it would have been in some other field, because there were no guitar departments in the United States
right.
other than just, like I said, these dozen or so strung out. Today, there's probably 1,200, you know, so it's been quite a change over 40 years.
In the modern world, with you're much more tuned in to what is selling for guitars and so forth than I am, but what is your typical client, the people that buy from you at Maple Street? Is there a demographic they fit particularly or not?
It's pretty wide-ranging, really. I mean, because in the case of lessons, you know, you have a range of people who are beginning as children, up to people who are beginning as retirees, you know. So the student population at our business is majority adult, not young kids.
Is that right? No, that's interesting.
Yeah, I would. I think it's been that way consistently for the 30-plus years I've been in business.
Wow.
So in which case, then, as far as guitars go, you're trying to meet the needs of the beginners at each stage. That's been a point that we address in our business. So it's very important to me that the very first guitar you get is not a guitar that's an obstacle to learning or a reason to quit. It has to be a first-class guitar, at least in terms of playability.
I bought a guitar, my first guitar, and I don't advise this for anybody. My first guitar, I think I paid $5 for it, yeah. and you know, the strings are about 2 inches off the fretboard.
Yeah, we see those. You know, it's a shame that people have to try to start. What that proves, though, is that it was a testament to your determination that you persisted with a guitar like that. So you were you know, in line to be a guitar player. If
there,
that's the case.
There is something, though, isn't there? I mean, when people pick out guitars, I don't know as much as you do about it, but you know, I think different guitars fit different people, and like you just like the way something feels and sounds, the way you play, and it's hard to describe why you just like the sound and the feel of it. Do you have any science for us on that, or is that just
well, that would be a longer radio show probably to talk about. You'd have to then talk about, you know, the sort of human perceptions, you know, sound, right, in the brain, right, and neuroscience. We'd have to call in Eric Kandel or something like that, who was a Nobel laureate in 2007 with dealing with this subject with respect to memory. But yeah, impressions and sound, I mean, it's an emotional thing first. You know, we try to suggest to people who are either, well, not usually to a beginner, because, you know, the sound is not so much the principal factor for the beginner. A lot of our customers are, of course, professional players, and then you have a lot of hobbyists and collectors. You know, we have as you know, since you've been in the shop, a wide range of instruments and high quality ones as well. So,
right.
But there's an emotional connection to sound. You know, we'll usually kind of, or at least I will, I'll try to say, don't try to rationalize an emotional decision.
Right.
If you try to find a way to describe what should be an ideal sound, and you look for it, you might neglect what would be the subtle, you know, more positive reaction to a sound. Touch makes a difference as far as the sound, how you attack the string. I spend a lot of time sometimes educating people about, you know, the character of a quality sound.
Right.
And trying to show them, you know, ways that you go about altering the vowel qualities of the tones that you make. You know, how in my case with fingerstyle playing, the nail plus the flesh and the combination of tension and so on, balances the ensemble to the extent that it's maybe, as you said, the Olympics of the guitar or world. I don't know if I would think of it that way, but, you know, the player's attention in the case of, say, the classical guitar repertoire is to, you know, produce a beautiful tone and have it balanced like a fine singing ensemble.
Right.
So it's important then to have a clear idea of how to produce a sound. You have a conception of it. But a lot of guitars you sit down and play, there are families of sound, just like there are families of wine. You know, I'll sometimes use the term in our business that if these guitars were grapes, you know, a Martin guitar is different than a Taylor. You know, it's a different grape. If you look at other guitars like Collings or Goodall or Santa Cruz, each kind of has a different character. And in my case, you know, 30 plus years of the business and 40 plus playing the guitar, I've played literally tens of thousands of guitars.
Right.
And I'm sort of like the wine sommelier. I know kind of what I to expect from different wood combinations and so on. So I try to listen to a customer. If they've been a player for some time, I like to know what instrument they've played, give me an idea of what you're looking for in contrast, and then I might know among our instruments if there's something suitable to try. Oftentimes, when I hear them play and they talk about what they want to do, I might actually think, well, you know, what they're looking for is the wrong thing. There might be something actually better for what they're doing.
You know, that happened to me at your shop. You know, I was in there playing, I think, a Taylor, a 12-string.
Mm-hmm.
And one of your guys, I think his name is Sean.
Mm-hmm.
Said, why don't you try this Martin? And I told him, I don't like Martins. And he said, we'll try this one. And I said, okay. And I ended up getting it. I promise I would never play that guitar. I would never pick it up because I had played a couple of Martin 12 strings, a different kind of 12 string, and I didn't like the sound of it at all. And I'm not enough of a musician to describe why.
Mm-hmm.
But when I played that one, I instantly liked it. And everybody I played it for and I've allowed to play it, I mean, they say the same thing. That's a great guitar. And I think it goes to what you say. I don't know the, you know, in my world, we're more, I'm not in the art business at all. We're in the electronic motor drive business. So, you know, if you want a motor to go faster or slower, you talk to me, and I just want to know what horsepower, how much torque you need, how fast you want it to go, what kind of response you need. And it's an engineering type thing, and we can work that right out. There's very little art to it. Sometimes in getting things repaired, we think there's an art to it occasionally, but as far as that, it's not that way. But you know, you are in a, you know, music is at its core level in art. I had Keith Getty, a great Irish hymn writer in here, and I was talking to him about why have some hymns endured for 600 years and others don't. And he said, why do some paintings endure? And so you can't, it's art. You can't, it's hard to put a quantitative, to quantify that. It's what appeals to the soul, and music is like that.
Yeah, no doubt. I mean, to the extent that I might try to objectify some of the characteristics of what you listen for in a sound, I'll sort of draw attention to balance, clarity, projection, and tone color.
Right.
And these are things that are relatively objective. You know,
right.
You would try to characterize those if you were discussing quality of tone,
right,
whether
right.
it's a singing ensemble or any kind of thing. And then, you know, the issue there is to describe that for a person by demonstration,
right.
And then let them use that information as they can and as they will to maybe aid in a way of trying to understand what they like about something.
Right.
Because it's when people are looking at pretty nice top quality instruments, they want to be able to justify the purchase other than the fact that they can afford it.
Exactly.
So it's they want it to be something that excites their musical imagination, and I try to leave it at that for them. You know, that's going to be the best selection in the end.
Well, George, in my case, I had to go and explain to my wife, why do you need another guitar? I mean, I'm sure you hear that everywhere from everybody.
Well, we separate needs from want, you know,
exactly,
so it's
exactly.
So they're kind of two different things altogether. And there you have to go justify why you want another guitar, I think.
Exactly. But I'm going to use some of your thing now and talk. I need a different vowel sound. I'm going to use that term. Tell her that. I don't think she'll buy it, but I'll tell her. I'll try to see how that goes. George, a great guest. Hang around. You're listening to Driven to Business. I'm Eddie Mayfield. Let me remind you again, we're streaming live on biz1190.com. We'll be podcast on eddiemayfield.com. Back in a moment. Welcome back to Driven to Business. We're talking with George Petch, the owner and the founder of Maple Street Guitars. And we've been talking about guitars, which I could talk about all day. Not that I'm a great guitar player, but I like being around people that are, which is I like being around George and people that know a lot about guitars, and it's fun to talk about them. And if you, any of you out there play guitars, let me encourage you to go drop by Maple Street Guitars. By the way, George, your website is, I think it's just maplestreetguitars.com. Isn't that correct?
That's correct.
Yeah, maplestreetguitars.com. Check them out. Also, there'll be links on eddiemayfield.com to George and his shop. Great music shop here in the Atlanta area, both for lessons and for new instruments. They have some beautiful instruments. You have some instruments in there, quite frankly, that, you know, one of your guys asked me if I wanted to play, and I just told him that was a better instrument than I knew how to play, so I just couldn't play. I didn't want to play that.
Yeah, we're scared of some of them ourselves.
I was scared to touch that. If I drop this thing is way out of my league. So I didn't want to fool with it. Let's talk a moment about we had alluded earlier to the fact you mentioned the fact that you've had guys with you for over 30 years.
Mm-hmm.
As I'm sure you know, in your business and in most businesses, that's not common. We go into these guitar music stores nowadays, and people have been there 6 months or 7 months, and they come in and out, and that's uncommon. I'd be interested in you telling us perhaps anything you can share with us about how you've done that, how you've kept these guys all these years, and how they came to you in the first place.
Well, it's a good question. Again, with the teachers first, because that's how I started the business. Many of the people who are teaching with us now are people that I knew when I was first learning to play. You know,
right.
they were starting the journey at the same time, and some were already
right.
teaching at that time. So when they chose to work with me when I opened the shop, you know, it was a privilege to have them there,
right. Right,
because they were already well schooled and had a successful sort of teaching program themselves, you might say.
Right.
But we're not a school of music, so the teachers who come there, you know, they do cover different broad styles. Like I said, I tried to recruit some people for the shop as well, And these were people that I had met in the community and respected as players and also as teachers. And as space became available, we would try to bring those people on. So it's so I think we all had kind of a shared language, and that made it easy, you know, and right. We had a shared mission, so that was kind of easy. I just happened to be a place where they could gather and, you know, in this case, do that. But with that, you know, like I said earlier, I started the shop with just a small number of instruments serving students' needs. As the teaching staff grew to the, whether 10 teachers other than myself, I still teach one day a week. I have to keep my hand in that, you know, so we needed instruments of different types. So the retail part of the business, you know, really outpaced, you know, the teaching component. Right. Even though there are about 300 plus students a week that come for lessons, it's really the growth of the retail part. And so I wanted to have instruments for, again, the student beginner as well as the intermediate and professional level player. And then we wanted repairs as well. So there's a repair staff, you know, the Jeff Henry, really fine builder and repairman's been with us for maybe 18 years. You know, I found him down at Bennett Street. He had a shop where he was building guitars, and I was doing repairs in-house, and I was overrunning my capacity to keep up with that kind of thing. You know, so, and then I do setups on everything we get. You know, so everything that comes in the store has to be previewed to make sure it's a best example. If it doesn't meet the standard, we send those away. And I have two other folks who work with me, Dave Bowling, who was I had met as a guitar player, and he also studied lute at a time I was doing that. I played for 10 years in an early music ensemble. Wow. And so we knew each other from that time. He had been working with a piano shop doing Steinway piano repairs, and I said, well, you know, guitars are a lot easier to work on than pianos. Come work with me.
You don't care, man. Sure.
And he loves guitars, so, and he's a great asset because he has plays such a variety of styles, and that's helpful when you're trying to understand what a person's needs are in repair. You know, you don't want to just fix something by some fixed numbers. You kind of know as a player, you know, what the guitar requires. Then we have another repairman, Jake Sharp, who had gone to one of the luthier schools, and we were looking for another repairman because I was trying to segue out of that myself. I spent a lot of my time in our repair shop because I'm very interested in the quality of our inventory. So recruiting him was a real bonus. And then the staff itself, you know, I mean, my wife works with me and my son works with me. So there it is, a family business. And I didn't have to work so hard to recruit them. You just conscript them. You know,
right,
so it's,
right.
But the other staff who work with us, we're very lucky to have a lot of very talented players, and many have been with us for many years. So they come to the business. I didn't actually go out and recruit most of those folks, but they come to the business. And, you know, we're looking for people who are, you know, have this, again, a standard of excellence, really, and, you know, what they do with their own music and you know, what they can bring in terms of their people skills.
So you know, as their leader, and I don't know you well, but just being around you, I'd be curious to know how you would describe your own leadership style around them. I know how I would describe it. I'm wondering how you would describe it.
You know, I'd hate to think it's just totally laissez-faire, but it's mostly, hopefully, quiet by example. You know,
right.
So I explain, you know, what I'm looking for in the relationships with the customers. We're not a commodity business. Our business, I describe it often as a relational business. You know, so
right.
We've been fortunate. It's kind of been the most interesting part of the ownership of that business, that over the last 30 years, we've had relationships with people who play the guitar for that long a period of time.
Right.
They've been coming into the store for 30 years. It makes you feel a little old and maybe a little institutional, but it's exciting at the same time because I've seen their music journey. So the important thing is to be involved in the person that comes in who has a dream to play, and then, you know, help facilitate that. So you're really kind of a matchmaker of sorts with the instruments and also with the again, what their aspirations are.
I think you are a leader by example. You know, I would describe you're very service oriented, and the term relational is a good term because you're a friendly, easily approachable guy. You know, a lot of people, I think, look at successful entrepreneurs like you, and they think that somehow, in order to be successful in business, you have to be this extremely aggressive, perhaps even abrasive in some ways, sales type. I'm not that way either, And neither, I'm not that way, and neither are you, I should say, I guess. And so, what if someone were to ask you, what's the secret of being successful in business? Not that either one of us could give a quick answer, could give a one sentence answer to that, but yeah. What's something you would say?
Well, integrity would be one thing.
That's a great one. Yeah.
It comes really from teaching, you know, so my business, right. My business practice is really not much different than teaching. If you come to me and want to learn to play the guitar, I'm going to invest all I can of my knowledge in your endeavor.
Right.
When it came to the instruments, it was actually hard for me at first. It was almost like an ethical dilemma, the idea of selling a guitar to my student, because, you know, obviously I'm in a position to, you know, take advantage of that if it's viewed in certain ways, but... So I found it hard in the beginning, but it was a struggle seeing people come, like I said, to lessons with new guitars that didn't play properly. They needed a lot of work. Fortunately, manufacturers make them better now. But regardless, you know, it was a careful line for me, you know, to deal with, to recommend a guitar that I was going to profit from in the sale of it, right? So, but, you know, the relationship was the most important thing to me. So they have to have one that, you know, if they don't even take lessons here, their teacher is going to be excited by that guitar and know that they got a good deal.
I promised myself in this segment we were only going to talk about business. But you raised a point there. I just would like to ask you. They make guitars better now. You know, a lot of people look at old classical Martins and Gibsons and you could probably name others back in those days that were in a lot of people's minds were like the heyday of guitars, but that's not necessarily true, is it?
No, it's you know, it's like I live in the Virginia Highland area in a house built in 1919, and just because it's old, it's not always better, you know.
Right.
I've done a lot of renovations and repairs over the last 30 plus years I've been in it, but some of the guitars, you know, that are iconic, you know, the ones that stand out were very well made instruments. They're not always as consistent, you know. So we see a lot of the old things float into the store and for repair, as well as just they come through. Maybe they were getting traded. I've never pursued that part of the business, the vintage guitar business, because finding quality inventory is so hard.
Yeah.
You know, and just because it's old, it's not better. I mean, there are a lot of old guitars that we've had come through the shop that, you know, you could take what you spent on that and buy five very fine, you know, modern guitars that will always be better instruments. And so the standards for making the guitar today, you know, have never been matched in the past. You know, so the understanding in terms of the science of how, you know, woods vibrate and communicate vibrational energy, that's a whole field you could talk about independent. The science of the woods themselves, what the builders understand about them. They're so much better informed. It's almost shame on them if they're not, you know.
Right.
And then where the manufacturers have gone offshore, you know, initially there was a lot of OEM manufacturing that was kind of iffy quality.
Right.
But now they're exporting a lot of the newer tools, the CNC routing machines and other kinds of tools. And when you have a company like Martin, you know, they have a shop in Mexico, as does Taylor. You have to bear in mind that they own that business. It's their factory. It's their tools. It's their wood. It's their supervisors. They just have the advantage of less expensive labor.
You know, I read Bob Taylor. I read his book. I think it's called Guitar Story or something like that. And it's actually a very interesting book from a business standpoint, I think. But, you know, one of the things he said in there was that when they began to go to this more standardized production, the idea was, I guess if you're hand building every guitar, then every guitar is going to sound different. So if you buy this model and Joe made it, and you buy this model and Fred made it, they're not going to be exact, because Fred and Joe are not going to do it exactly the same. But then, you know, guys like Taylor, we put a process in there where it's exactly. He said his goal was to have them exactly the same. That guitar A is just like guitar B. And there's got only some a few differences in the wood and things like that, you know,
Yeah, ultimately they're not the same. But like I said earlier, there's a family of sound. It's Taylor.
Right.
You know, and you hear Taylor guitars, you can play everyone in our shop, and then anyone that has the same wood type as a Martin guitar, say, we just use those two big names as examples.
Right.
They're like the Coke and Pepsi of the guitar world.
Right.
You know, if you were going to do the taste test, you would never probably confuse the Taylor sound for the Martin sound.
Right.
And so they both have some of the most sophisticated.
And they play very differently, too, as you
they
well
They play differently.
Well,
yeah, they're design components that make them unique. And
right.
So players choose them for those reasons.
Right, exactly. You're listening to Driven to Biz. One more segment to come. I'm Eddie Mayfield. We're talking with George Petch with Maple Street Guitars. By the way, links to him will be on eddiemayfield.com. It's also maplestreetguitars.com. Back in a moment. Welcome back to Driven to Business. We're talking with George Petch with Maple Street Guitars. Again, that's maplestreetguitars.com. Also, there'll be links to George and his company on eddiemayfield.com. So check us out on that. And you've already said this a little bit, because you've had relationships with customers for a long time, but in general, if you had to come up with it, how do people find out about you? How do they know you're here around?
That's a real good question, because we don't advertise overtly. I've tried off and on over the years, just minimal kind of local advertisement.
Right.
I have to say it's really fundamentally on a local level, word of mouth. So over the years when you've, worked with so many customers and then students, if they've had a good experience, and we hope all of them do, they hopefully will tell their friends. So it's a sort of networking, like snail mail, I guess, but, now, of course, we've had a website for many years. We've not been interested in e-commerce, so our website is more informational. It's updated with all of our stuff every 24 hours, the inventory and so on. There is a Facebook component to that, and that has some outreach, beyond that, I'd say the web probably brings more people to us now. I mean, though we're not an e-commerce site, because of the selection of things that we have in our business, we have things that no one's going to find anywhere else in the state of Georgia.
Right.
We have then customers who come from out of state, and we sell quite a few things, maybe something like close to 18%. Kind of surprised me last year, somewhere around 18% goes out of state. So that's always surprising to me, because we think people should have the guitar in hand before they select it. But, to the extent that people think of certain instruments as commodities, they'll order that way. In other cases, on the top quality instruments, ironically, they're the ones that are most often ordered, because you might be somewhere in the Dakotas or something, and, there's no guitar shop. And for you to get one of those guitars, you can afford it. You'll have it shipped out there. We'll give you 2 days to try it out. If you can't decide in 2 days, I'm not sure, that you should have that guitar. So, so they may come back to us, but oftentimes that's a different kind of process. So they find us, we'd like to be relevant locally. I mean, that's our goal, to be a local community asset. To do that, though, there's just new people coming along all the time. You'd have to be out knocking on doors almost. But our in-house staff, all of them perform. The teachers perform, so that's also a way of contacting people. Every time when I performed that I was playing somewhere, there would usually be someone kind enough to say something nice about my playing and then ask about what I do, and I would hand them a card, and business would start from that.
I first came to your shop, and I had heard of it before, but I first came to your shop. You had a, I forget, I'm kind of what Taylor called this, a road show.
A road show.
Yeah, I came to your shop, and that's very, that was fun, because it's the second one I've been to, but they go over a little bit of what the differences in woods and body shapes and this, that, and the other, which is, in fact, I began trying something after the road show that I went to there, when the guy suggested that you start playing with different picks. I was playing the same pick all the time. So I started using a different pick, and it kind of varies your playing style. I never thought of that, because I always wanted to be sure I got the exact same pick, but I started getting different picks, and I sort of pick a pick now depending on what I feel like playing like. It sort of changed my deal. You've obviously made a career based on your passion, and in my experience, and I think in a lot of people's experience, passion cannot be discounted. I was talking to someone last night about their career, and he was telling me about how that he just loved what he was doing, and he can't imagine doing something he didn't love doing. Now, I know there are a lot of people that may find that an alien concept, perhaps in some ways. But you're a passionate guy. Have you got any thoughts about that?
Well, I think it's a mix in my case. Like I said, the passion was for the music and the teaching.
Right.
The retail business is a harder deal. But that's how I earn a living. And And what I have a passion for is really the people who come in there for it.
Right.
And then my, I guess that extends to, you know, what we try to do to have the kinds of things that will, you know, satisfy their interest, but also encourage right. them to come back and then maybe tell other people. So it's connecting with that, you know, it's because I, you know, I guess like every guitar, probably everyone in our shop would rather be home practicing and playing the guitar. You know? So, you know, well, we have to earn a living, and as a way of earning a living, I'd have to say it's been interesting that I could make a business out of this particular passion for me, you know, but so it's because it's my goal is not to have a big thing, you know, or mini stores or anything like that. It's really just to, you know, focus on the high quality of the one thing, you know, and it's that's what we try to do.
I think back to this word of mouth thing just for a moment. We've talked on here a number of times on our program a number of times about the importance of word of mouth. And in fact, I've often said that I think word of mouth trumps all other advertising, even in this incredibly connected digital society we live in. In fact, you can read a lot of pretty clear thinkers in the marketing area have said that there's almost a reaction. We're so bombarded with information these days and so many advertising messages that we have all almost unconsciously developed filters where we don't hear them. And that's why you can watch a television program and not be able to name a single commercial that was on that program, because and you're set there, but you're so tuned out of it, you just tune that out. Mm-hmm. And you pay no attention to it. But word of mouth is a whole nother story. And, you know, I know in our business, it's extremely important that customers are happy with us on all the levels, that, mm-hmm. that they like the technical work we did. They like the way we treated them. They like the way we were friendly to them. We respond to their questions. We answer phones. We don't, you know, all that. We return calls if we say we're going to. We return emails if we say we're going to. Mm-hmm. All of those kinds of things. We've used the example here a number of times. Isaac and I have talked about it. You know, you could hear there are restaurants advertised all over Atlanta. I mean, just constantly. You can hear it on the radio. You know, you hear it all, everywhere. But if I'm going to go eat lunch around here somewhere and I don't know anything around here, and I ask Isaac and say, Isaac, what's a good restaurant to go to around here? I'm probably going to what Isaac says, mm-hmm. not to what. And so all those advertisements are just trumped instantly by what somebody else says. And I think when people have a good experience here with Maple Street, and I know, like I said, a lot of your customers, and they all speak very highly of your store. And I don't actually know anyone taking lessons from you, but I do know people that have bought guitars from you, the retail side of it, and you know, strings and things like that. And I do think that sort of buzz or word of mouth is much more important than a website. Although all of us, we make our company, we do, you know, $7 million a year off our website from business. So I don't disdain the web at all. In fact, I don't know how in the world we'd live without it these days.
It's an essential component to your business. It's just how many windows can you dress in a retail
right.
business? So
exactly.
you have the one there at the shop, of course, and then you have a Facebook thing, and that's almost like you have to put in a video, what would you call it, studio to produce
right.
these things.
Right, right.
You know, and all of that's important, and people depend on it. There's a word of mouth that comes through, of course, the internet, like Yelp and all these other kinds of things
right.
that can be helpful or damaging, because
right.
there's a lot of you know, reckless folks out there, you know, who will say things that are not quite true. But you know, we've had good response even from that, and but we depend on that probably the most. Websites are fundamentally narrow casting, you know,
right,
unless
right.
you decide you're going to buy space up, you know, on a Google sideband for advertising. We haven't done that, you know. So for the kinds of things that we expect people to seek us out for on the internet, these are the high quality things typically,
right?
Not the commodity things you might say, like
right.
strings or accessories. I don't expect to ever sell things like that typically over the internet. But for those kinds of things, there are very few of a lot of that made. So people are going to find their way to us, you know, and because they'll seek out an instrument and realize, well, there's not one in California. There's not one in,
right.
you know, New York. Oh, look, here's one in Atlanta. Let me call them up. So that's how that would work out.
George, you've been a great guest. Thanks so much for coming on Driven to Business. I could talk to you forever. And let me remind folks again to check George out at maplestreetguitars.com. You've been listening to Driven to Business. I'm Eddie Mayfield. We're here every Saturday morning at 11 o'clock right here on Atlanta's Biz 1190, and we'll see you next week.
You've been listening to Driven to Business with your host, Eddie Mayfield. Visit next Saturday at 11 a.m. on Biz 1190 for more Driven to Business. To learn more about Driven to Business, visit eddiemayfield.com or call 770-448-4644.